Alan, reel 8. So liberation came slowly, as it were.
Yes, it did rather. And there we were in Jakarta, in this camp. And to our great excitement, the British Navy sent down a small force to show the flag. I think it was the county-class cruiser Dorsetshire with half a dozen minesweepers. Not, you might say, a force to instill fear into anybody, because the Japanese had about 50,000 troops in Java, all armed to the teeth. However, they were welcomed by the Japs, dropped anchor in the harbour, and a delegation from the ships, led by the Commodore, or whatever, came ashore, met by the Japanese, all in their best uniforms, gleaming cars, and they all drove to the camp. And there we were. We all put on our best clothes, such as we had. And then you had these apparitions, these smart naval officers with gleaming white uniform, and all looking very fit, long hair. You see, we all had our hair shaved off, hair reasonable length, surrounded by Japanese officers with their best uniforms and swords, all beaming away through their glasses. It was really quite extraordinary. And so we met these chaps, you see, and they were all completely at the mercy of the Japanese, but as I say, the Japs had been told to make them welcome, so they jolly well did. And this was really quite a remarkable occasion. And the next day or so, Sam Four and I had a very pleasant surprise, because one of the minesweepers was commanded by a chap called Dennis Richardson, who was a Jerseyman. And he had made it his business during the war, wherever his ship went, he always checked around to see of the local garrisons or whatever if there were any Jerseymen around. So he got our names and invited us out to the ship. Can you imagine? So they sent a wagon, and we put on our best uniforms, as they were, and went down to the port, Tanjong Priok, into a boat, out to the ship, you see. And so we set foot on one of HM ships again for the first time.
What was that like?
Oh, it was fantastic. I mean, it was only a small minesweeper, for God's sake, but, you know, what the hell, you know, to step aboard the ship and salute the quarterdeck again, you know, well, really. Of course, the rest of the ship's company and the officers there, you see, there were about four or five officers, if that, they all regarded us as something like, I think, interest and awe that, you know, that obviously we looked as if we'd been through thin time, which we had. I remember going down the boardroom and they said, "What would you have to drink?" And, you know, nobody said that to us for 4 years. And I thought, well, I think I'll have a beer. I haven't had a beer before yet. I said, "Ice beer." Can you imagine an ice beer after? It was marvellous. And of course, it was just a really short visit. I mean, we spent the day on the ship and chatting to people.
How did you get on with the food? Because you've been on a very plain.
Oh, well, that was all right. One didn't suffer from overeating. It wasn't, you know, that was all right. One got accustomed to that all right.
What do you think their reaction was to your thinness and so on? I mean, you must have looked sort of horrifyingly.
Oh, yes, tremendous sympathy. You see, I mean, tremendous sympathy. And but I say it's a mixture of sort of delicacy and awe. They didn't like to say, "My God, you fellas are thin." Or, but you
must
know,
must have been horrified.
I think they probably were. Yes, that's right. But too polite to say much, okay. Being English. Yes, that was a really most remarkable episode that you'd be whipped out like that. And
did you feel, I mean, I think I'd have felt anger towards these blasted Japanese who were suddenly being so nice.
Oh, yes, it was the case. So yes, one did really feel that, but it was sort of unproductive. But, I mean, some people always felt different. I mean, my senior officer, who was Lieutenant Commander Cooper, he was the first lieutenant of Exeter, who wrote a book about all this called Never Forget, Never Forgive. He maintained his anger at boiling point till the end of his life. And I, you know, he he just hated the very thought of them all the time. Whereas Sam Fall, you see, for example, has overcome that. He hasn't got any hatred. He realizes, you know, that there were forces there that are bigger than all of us. He hasn't got any hatred for them. And in fact, he's made a good friend of the lieutenant in the destroyer which picked us up, which, you know, after all, this ship saved our lives.
Yeah. How do you feel?
I don't feel anger now, because it was all, they were as much victims of circumstance as we were. In fact, they were under the control of a far more merciless regime than we could ever realize. I feel a certain amount of contempt for the nation, that they could behave as they did do. You know, this slavish obedience to orders. I know one has to obey orders, but, you know, there is a limit, and there are certain degrees in which one has to say, you can't do that sort of thing, old boy. You see, and, you know, I feel that I don't feel anger now, but I say a certain degree of contempt. And I never have been to Japan, and I don't particularly regret it at all. I wouldn't like to be surrounded by them all the time, even if I could speak Japanese, you know, one would always be so cut off, really. So, although it hasn't stopped me buying a Japanese car, because it's jolly good value for money, and I didn't object to thinking this little bastard's working hard for me. But
did your heart ever take a bit of a leap, you know, when you see some groups of Japanese in London or what, you know, wherever?
Yes, I suppose it does, really. Yes, it did. You see that. But on the whole, I'm rather sorry for them, really, that you know, that they have this rather crushing system, which, as we know, is still very strong. Like, for example, the position of the Crown Prince and Crown Princess in Japan now, which one got to know something about through their mutual acquaintances. You know, very, very crushing. I mean, we may think that our royal family is a bit odd in some respects, but I mean they have a great deal more freedom than the Japanese royal family do. Mm. However,
so going back to having done your trip to the minesweeper.
Oh yes.
How
well, then okay, so it was a case of being getting home, getting back out of the island. I might say that certain of armed forces, like the Canadians, for example, heard that there were two Canadians down in Java, and they immediately sent a plane for them and got them out, you see, immediately. And my good friend, who was one of them, he disappeared, and we met again about 30 years later. But yes, but of course they couldn't. The Navy couldn't quite do that, so the Navy sent a couple of landing craft. So we were told, you know, the good news that we were going to be taken to Singapore, and the bad news was we were going in landing craft, which were not designed for that sort of trip. So it took about 2 days chugging up, and it was, these are flat-bottomed tubs, you know, and I think we were all seasick, and the food was execrable, because it was bully beef, you know, and it was cooked in a inadequate arrangements on a landing craft, I ask you. So so that wasn't a very jolly trip.
No seats, I imagine.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, it seemed to be very, what I can remember, very crude. However, the last interesting episode of the whole war really occurred in Singapore. We got to Singapore and got out onto the dockside, and there were other ships there. Unloading ammunition and stuff. And they were being unloaded by Japanese prisoners of war. And the extraordinary thing was that whereas all the British prisoners, you know, had worked as slowly as they possibly could, there were these Japs who were almost running into the ship, picking up a box of ammunition on their shoulders, running out and dumping it in. You could almost see the ship coming out of the water. It was being unloaded so quickly. And all these Japs were perfectly happy, as if as if they thought the emperor was watching them. Perhaps they thought he was, you know. But as far as they were concerned, they'd had orders to get that ship unloaded, and they'd do it, you see. Yeah. Anyway, so then we were on the dockside, waiting to go to some transit camp. And we were told that Sir Primo wanted to come, was coming down to see us. That was Lord Mountbatten, who was the, you know, the in charge of Southeast Asia Command. So we hung about for a shot, and in a cloud of dust, and down the road came three jeeps. The first one and the third were full of red caps, and in the middle was one with Lord and Lady Mountbatten. Mountbatten, looking very debonair, of course, he leapt out of his jeep without opening the door, you know, and strode in amongst us, shaking hands all round, you see, and jumped up onto an oil drum and said a few words, you know, just, you could imagine, said the right thing, glad to see you, Chasbeth. And then a most remarkable thing happened, in my view. He then said, any of you chaps served with me? Because we were all naval leaves. Any of you chaps served with me? Well, he'd been in the Kelly, you know, and other ships during the war, and had a few ships sunk under him, rightly or wrongly. Whether it was due to his fault or not, I don't know. Anyway, any of you chaps served with me? And up went two or three hands. And immediately he said, Stoker Jones, how are you? All right, sir. You know, Petty Officer Smith. And he knew their names. And I thought, that's amazing, because, I mean, these chaps weren't looking their best. They weren't looking very smart, you know. And he had a reputation of knowing everybody's name in his ship, that you're always told you should know the name of everybody in your command. But he certainly had a reputation for it. Now, whether he had actually remembered them, as I think he had, or, I mean, even if he had been briefed, that's pretty... Yes, that's right, you see. And I don't think he was briefed. I think he really did it. And honestly, it was the most impressive piece of public relations on the part of a senior officer that I've ever seen. It was remarkable. And, of course, by the time he'd finished, we were all eating out of his head. I must say, people have said things about Mountbatten, and he was obviously a very self-important person, and he... after himself, of course, but he was certainly very competent, and he certainly was very much respected and liked by the ship's companies he was with.
Did he inspect you, and did Lady Mountbatten come around?
I think she came around and, you know, said a few words. In my memory, it was very much overshadowed by his presence and his what he did, and I don't remember anything really from her, except she's standing there looking gracious I think it was a St. John's ambulance or something uniform, you know. But so then it was a case of transit camp and ship home. Mm.
So did it take you long to? Did you spend long in the transit camp and on the journey back?
We didn't.
Well,
that's right, yes. We didn't spend long in camp, if I remember right. We did go around Singapore, a couple of friends of ours, it's a bit of sightseeing. And, of course, the local Singaporeans were out for business and trade, trying to get you to buy things. We didn't have any money. But we did have enough money to I went with a friend of mine, and we thought we'd have our photographs taken, which I still got. I took my cap off. I had a cap. So I thought it would be quite nice to show myself, you know, show with my hair cut off. And then my friend thought he'd look better with his cap on, but I thought it not. I wasn't there to show how good looking I was. I want a record. Yeah. Anyway, but then we came home, I say, and stopped at in Egypt, in Suez Canal, where there was a big army depot where we were kitted out with some warmer clothing, and we arrived in Birkenhead in a rainstorm. But they didn't mind that.
No. So what sort of reception was laid on for you at Birkenhead?
Not very much, if I can remember. Trains and things to get us home to where we wanted to go. But not very much. I don't remember. There was no brass band or anything like that. I think this wasn't like... Well, of course, we don't wear our patriotism, I suppose, on our sleeve like the Americans tend to do. But certainly it was very low-key, and certainly there was no debriefing. There was no counselling. No.
Would you have liked someone to talk to for
an hour? I suppose, well, I never really worried about it. I mean, one thought, well, that's that episode over, I've survived, thank goodness, and you've got your memories and that sort of thing. But, you know, I never... let's get on with the next item, which was to go to... back in the Navy and do some training for one's long-delayed promotions, you see, which we did.
What was it like leaving all the people you'd been with for so long, been through so much?
Well, I didn't, I don't think there were any tears, you know. The midshipmen I was with, we were all going to meet up again anyway to do our training, you see, and, no, I wouldn't say we were, I didn't think it was terribly emotional, no.
So you had some leave then,
didn't you? Yes, and I had some leave, and I was able to go back to Jersey to meet my parents again.
Where like, I mean, they must have been overcome.
Oh, yes, it was. Obviously, I don't know. You see, as an optimistic 23-year-old who'd survived, you know, I was looking forward to getting on with life, you see, which had been, so to speak, on hold for so long. And I don't think I realised quite... I mean, looking back now, I mean, one was obviously very glad to see one's parents, and they were overjoyed to see me, and you know, difficult to say that I don't suppose one could possibly live up to their expectations. Not that anything was wrong, but that it was, I suppose I was a bit casual about it all, you see, and my father, who was ex-service, had a much better idea, I think, of what it must have been like than my mother, who still thought I was a 15-year-old, I think, you know. Get her son back. Oh, dear. You know, it must have been very, very tough for them. Certainly their war was tough, being occupied, you know.
Mm. So you had a long leave, or...?
Yes, I think we had about a couple of months' leave. Uh-huh. Back pay, of course, which, as I was a midshipman on most of the time on 5 shillings a day, it didn't amount to very much. So, but I suppose perhaps I got £1,000 on the end of it, which was quite a lot in those days, you see.
Lot, yeah.
Quite a lot. And there was there was a sort of backdating of promotion, etc. It was all done very fairly, I think, but so that was quite nice. And one had 2 ration books. My mother was very pleased about that. 2 ration books.
So
that
you needed feeding up.
Oh, yes, that's right. She certainly thought of that. So,
and did you have a medical checkup? Did you know what you were deficient in? Or?
Well, that was again interesting that I was to have a medical checkup, and this was to be, in Guernsey. So there I was in Jersey. I had to get the boat to Guernsey, go through some army huts, where I was given a very cursory medical checkup, and I went back to Jersey. And that, as far as I can remember, is all that happened. I had malaria, and this recurred at intervals, at decreasing intervals, for perhaps the next 5 years. But gradually got less and less. But again, no question of the War Office taking much notice of that, or even admitting responsibility. No.
Did you have dreams about the camp?
I suppose I did. Yes, I suppose so. I suppose I must have done. But not excessively so.
Not nightmares?
Oh, no nightmares. No, I don't think so. No, I didn't have that.
Because some people did, didn't they?
Oh, I'm sure they were.
Some people never really recovered.
I'm sure, that's right, yes.
So why do you think you survived?
Well, I mean, I didn't have such a tough time. Mm. I mean, people... now kindly ask me, you know, it must be pretty terrible. Well, of course, it was pretty grim. But frankly, I mean, compared with what other people went through during the war.
We didn't know that at the time, though.
No. Well, we knew that, I say, that, like I mentioned, these airmen who'd been to Heruku, I mean, they had been worked until they died. Canada and starved into the bargain, and they had a terrible time. And we knew, of course, that that the Siamese railway was going on, and that was a pretty grim. We knew if you were making a railway under in tropical conditions with a tight deadline, it must be awful. But basically, I mean, I'm not sort of being modest, but nearly 4 years as a Japanese prisoner was no joke. But on the other hand, you know, it was nothing. I mean, it was nothing compared to what went on in the world in those years and indeed before.
Yes, it sounds as though you kept a real sense of proportion.
Well, I hope so. You know, I hope so. I mean, it could have been much, much worse. You know, and to this face it, you know, like the. I said, the Abbe C.S. after the French Revolution, and he said, you know, I survived, you see. One can only be grateful for that, and whatever gods there be.
So you stayed on in the Navy?
Well, I stayed on in the Navy for a year or so. But you see, as I may have mentioned before, I had joined up in the Indian Navy, and normally I would have gone out to India. Immediately I had completed my sub-lieutenant's training and became a sub-lieutenant. Well, all this, of course, was much deferred. So I didn't go out to India until I was, until February 1947, right? Because after my training in sub-lieutenant, well, I was a lieutenant by then, I was then appointed to a naval ship, a destroyer, HMS Fernie, in the home waters. And then I was sent out to India. By that time, I'd married, and we went out to India in February 47. Well, things were in the considerable confusion out there, as you can imagine. I was posted to a shore establishment near Bombay, and when the independence of India came, I was made redundant. You see, I was retired. I was told I could transfer to the RN if I liked. They'd take me in the RN, you see, or I could retire. Well, by that time, as I say, I was married, and I thought, I don't think I want to stay in the Navy, playing at wartime games again for the rest of my life. So we took retirement, and I took the compensation I was given, and was able to get a grant from Middlesex County Council, a small grant, and I went to Imperial College and got a degree in civil engineering. Mm-hmm. And I never regretted leaving the Navy. I mean, I've met since then people who've stayed on, but and they've had interesting careers, but I never regretted it.
And what branch of engineering did you?
I did civil engineering.
Right. Uh-huh. And you stayed as a civil engineer for the rest of your life, didn't you?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I took a degree in civil engineering, and then when I graduated, I got a job with ICI. And I thought, well, what I don't know about chemical engineering, but of course, in ICI, it was a big firm, and you had engineers of all breeds there, you see, instrument engineering, mechanical, civil, electrical, the lot. And so there was a very wide choice of engineering jobs, and gradually one left the civil part and went on to project engineering, that sort of thing. So, you know, it was an interesting firm to work for, a good firm.
And you stayed with them, didn't you?
I stayed with them all the rest of my until I retired.
Right.
And, I think I, again, very luckily, I think I had the best years, because poor old ICI now is, things have caught up with it. It's no longer the finest company in the country as it was.
Yeah, and you travelled a lot during your work, didn't you?
Not a lot, no. I did, I think I was 26 years with ICI, and I did most all that was in England, but I did have 2 years in Mombasa in East Africa for the company, and 4 years in Brazil for the company. So that was, you know, fair bit of travelling. Certainly, they were both interesting assignments, and I wouldn't have missed those. So altogether, I had what I think was a very, you know, interesting time with ICI. Didn't become chairman of the company, but just as well I didn't. I wouldn't be so happy now as I am as I am now.
Lots of characters you've mentioned. Are there any other areas of individuals that you'd like to add on, as it were?
Oh, characters. Well, I've well, I mentioned Van der Post, the old liar. My senior officer was George Cooper, who I'm sure there's, if anybody's interested, you know, there's plenty of information about him. He got an obituary in the Times, I think it was.
How did you find him? What was
your? Well, he was rather a naval officer of the old school, and rather a bit of a disciplinarian, very much believing in, you might say, some of the old naval myths, you know. And I remember one occasion when we were all sitting around, a group of people, and talking about life and possibilities. And George said, well, he said, better death than dishonor. What? And everybody sort of thought, well, nobody liked to argue, you know, there was sort of stunned silence. Really? The next? Grow up. However, that was George, and he was a brave man. There's no doubt about it. He was, perhaps he was a bit blinkered, and his life was the Navy, but he was certainly a brave man.
Are you glad you went in the Navy and not in anything else?
Oh, yes. I know. I mean, you know, goodness knows, there's a lot of luck in this sort of thing. And, yes, I'm glad I did. And, in a way, see, had I not been captured, I could have, been sunk and killed somewhere else. You just don't know. I was lucky to survive two sinkings. And, but of course, the whole thing hasn't given me a great deal of confidence in the higher command either. Because obviously, there's enough bright people in the top of the Navy, or then and now, to manage to carry some of the deadbeats, I think.
So, do you blame the higher command for some of the problems that?
Oh, I certainly blame. I mean, I've got enormous respect for Churchill, but there's no doubt he had some blind spots, and one of them was his reliance upon Admiral Tom Phillips, you know, who took the Prince of Wales and repulsed to the bottom. I think Tom Phillips was a disaster, and had he survived, he should have been court-martialed. He was a disaster. He had perhaps an impossible task, but you know, he wasn't big enough to say, "I'm not going to go off to this will-o'-the-wisp of Japanese ships. I'm going to keep in the background a bit." He wanted to get glory, and he wanted it at once, and he wanted it for himself. You know, well, I mean, that's not the best recipe for success, is it? But it's a recipe for it's hubris, isn't it?
Absolutely. Right. Well,
all right.
If you've finished, I'll just say Graham Allen has been most interesting. Thank you very much indeed. That's the end of Reel 8.